Cable News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on Cable News In Depth, we're airing part one of Cable reporter Emily Gresham Beamer's interview with filmmaker Josh Tucker about the proposed pebble mine in southeast Alaska and his documentary entitled We Can't Eat Gold.
I'm Emily Gresham Beamer for Cable News. The largest open-pit gold mine in the world has been proposed in the Bristol Bay watershed, which also happens to have the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. The Army Corps of Engineers is accepting public comments on the project until May 30th. Today, I'm speaking with filmmaker Josh Tucker about the realities of the proposed pebble mine and the fierce community resistance that has followed the proposal. Josh directed the 2013 documentary, We Can't Eat Gold, which chronicles the resistance of Alaska's native communities to the pebble mine. He released an updated version of his documentary for free at wecanteatgold.net. Thanks so much for speaking with me, Josh. Could you first describe how the massive proposed pebble mine would be created and what entities are behind it?
The pit would be 2 miles by 3 miles and at least a mile deep. So we're talking about gouging a huge chunk of land out among the headwaters of the Bristol Bay watershed, which, as you said, is the most productive sockeye salmon run in the world. And the folks who live there depend on it for their subsistence diet. They don't live on the road system. The Pebble Partnership is sort of a shell corporation that's been run by Canadian mining corporation Northern Dynasty pursuing this. And Northern Dynasty is also a very comparatively small mining company. So they've sought co-investors over the years. What's happened is that as soon as Alaska Native elders got wind of this proposed project, I think that they saw it as a huge threat to their way of life. And so many elders went to different shareholder meetings in London and in Canada to speak out and say, hey, Mitsubishi, Rio Tinto, Anglo American, Quantum Plus Minerals, don't invest in this. And so over the years, each of those 4 major international mining companies have invested and then walked away from their investment, walked away from the proposed pebble mine, because these major economic players can see that it doesn't make a lot of sense. The world's biggest investment firm, BlackRock, just pulled out in January. So we can see that when financial minds look at this, they can see that it doesn't make a lot of sense. But the current CEO of the Pebble Partnership, Tom Collier, has been promised a $12 million bonus if the mine is permitted and those permits stand up against a very likely legal challenge. And so I think that what you're seeing here is because this mine, miners project and they tell their investors that it has $500 billion or $500 billion worth of minerals, gold, copper, molybdenum, and others in the ground there. Some folks are willing to run a lot of risks to extract that gold with their proposed pebble mine.
You talked about a largely successful divestment campaign led by Native leaders. That campaign was a success, like diverting investment from this mine. So is it kind of like a one man against the world thing here?
When a CEO goes out there and says, hey, we've got $500 billion worth of minerals in the ground here, we just need your help to get it out, A lot of folks will take interest in that. And so there has been a lot of support over the years, but you know, with this divestment campaign, Tiffany's and other jewelers signed a promise to boycott any gold from the proposed pebble mine, and its environmental organizations like the Natural Resources Defense Council and Trout Unlimited, as well as commercial fishing organizations, have all worked in concert as allies in a fight led by Alaska Native elders and youth to block this. And it's been an ongoing fight since 2007. I think, you know, one really critical point is that the Northern Dynasty may not even have enough funds to bring the proposed pebble mine through the permitting process. So they've lost all their big investors, but now they find their big supporters, notably in the Trump administration and in the folks that Trump has running the EPA.
So this proposed mine would be, you said, thousands of feet deep, miles wide. If it goes forward, it would be dug on lands that have been inhabited for thousands of years by Alaska's Native communities. Could you speak a bit more about how tribal leaders and their communities have reacted to the possibility of a mine of this size and what steps they've taken? You mentioned the divestment campaign. What other ways are they resisting this mine within their communities?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it helps to sort of take a step back and paint a little bit of a word picture of Bristol Bay. So we got an area that's the size of the state of Ohio. There's no road system. So people get between the 32 tribal villages in the area on float planes, sometimes on snow machines, and boats when they can. And so orange juice is $17 a gallon at times in the store. You know, there's not big box stores. Everything has to be brought in on bush planes or on a barge, which comes just a few times a year. So folks really depend off the salmon. You know, on average, the tribal communities in Bristol Bay say that over 50% of their diet is subsistence, which means it doesn't come from the grocery store. It comes from food that they harvest off the land. 60 to 80% of the subsistence, so 30 to 40% of food overall, is this sockeye salmon. So when tribal elders were working with biologists and understanding that acid mine drainage and the toxins that are leached inevitably, even without a tailings pond breach, from large-scale hard rock mining like this, that acid mine drainage has an effect on salmon and it blunts their sense of smell to the point where they can't follow the same path that they traveled as fry back to the exact same place in the river where they were born to dig their reds and spawn there. So contamination could stop in one generation the salmon's ability to reproduce, because they only reproduce the exact same place they were born. They can't find their way back there. I think that elders took it very seriously. And so Bobby Andrew, who's a main character in We Can't Eat Gold, worked with other folks in a consortium of tribal governments based in traditional councils and some village corporations to reach out to the EPA. And so in 2007, during the end of the George W. Bush's administration, they began to reach out to the EPA, and it was under the Obama administration that they were able to get the EPA to commission what's called the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. And so they did a hundreds of page long study with cultural anthropologists and biologists and seismologists. And the EPA determined to implement a proposed determination under Clause 404C of the Clean Water Act. And this clause is rarely used, but it allows the EPA to, in some cases, block a major industrial project and say, we will not even allow this project to reach the permitting phase because we feel its threat to people in the environment is too great. And so after exhaustive study, the EPA decided that Pebble Mine, the proposed Pebble Mine, would indeed be one of these exceptionally risky projects, and they blocked it. For tribal leaders to work with the EPA and really bring the EPA in was a real big step. If you think about, you know, living off the road system, you don't have internet, and the amount of advocacy that they undertook to get a federal government agency to do a major study and then come to a decision which has limited precedent. That I think that's, along with the divestment campaign, their campaign to get more federal peer-reviewed science on the record also had a sizable effect and drove away a lot of those biggest investors. You saw Anglo American pulling out shortly after that decision was announced by the EPA.
A lot of discussions in the media about the danger that this mine would pose to Native communities and their relationship with salmon. It talks about disrupting it or impacting it. So it sounds like from what you're saying that it could foreseeably end this relationship for future generations. Is that correct?
Yeah. No, I would absolutely say that's a fair way of reading what tribal elders themselves say. Is that they believe that if they get a big mine up there, that fishing and mining don't coexist, that one loses and it'll be fish that lose. And that would represent not only a reduction in the amount of fish that they're able to catch, but an eradication of a way of life that is preserved in very few places around the world. In the film, We Can't Eat Gold, the first chief of the Chagyung Tribal Council, Tom Tilden, makes a comparison to buffalo in the Great Plains state. And he said, you know, they just couldn't live without their buffalo, and we can't live without our salmon. So in addition to the salmon biologically being a keystone species that all the other species in the environment depend on, the bears and the eagles and the other mammals, the salmon is almost like a cultural keystone species. When the thaw comes to Bristol Bay and the salmon come back in June and some of the kings come in May, so as soon as people are getting out of winter, they're starting to think about getting ready for fishing, you know, and what happens is people put up fish camps. So your whole extended family, the kids you know go to that one-room schoolhouse with, all come together and go down and build a little cabin on the river, set up tents, and you're camped out down by the gravel bar where the salmon come in, oftentimes for months, for the whole summer subsistence gathering period, right? And so that's where a lot of different generations come together, and older generations pass on those subsistence skills. These subsistence skills that get practiced with salmon are oftentimes very similar to ones that were practiced hundreds and thousands of years ago. Now there are some motors on the boats, but this is not a subsistence practice that relies on firearms. They use a lot of fish traps and dip netting and set netting many times that are really similar to the way they've been doing it for a long time. So if the fish weren't there, all that passing on of cultural knowledge wouldn't happen. All that community, great family time wouldn't happen. And so folks would have a lot less access to affordable and healthy food and a lot less community time. To me, that just sounds like something that I can really understand when tribal leaders and youth say this is not what we want for our community.
Are there other subsistence sources that would be impacted?
Sure. I mean, there's all the freshwater fish. There's ptarmigan, caribou. With salmon as a keystone species, if you lose the keystone species in an ecosystem, the ripple effects are rapid. You know, Rick Halford, who was the majority leader of the Alaskan state legislature, a Republican, he looked at this mine drainage and he said, you know what, you couldn't put that mine in a better place to spoil both drainages of the major river systems that run out of there. So we're not even talking about just the impact in the 20 miles around the mine, around the natural gas pipeline that they would need to put in to support it, around the ferry terminal, ice-breaking ferry terminal to break their stuff across Lake Iliamna and eventually Cook Inlet. Not even just the impact of the infrastructure, but the chemicals, the acid mine drainage, the arsenic that they still say they're going to use in this process. We see that when that gets into a drainage, that it can go hundreds of miles and really ruin a lot of great salmon habitat, because it starts in some of the most productive tributaries. So it goes through the whole system.
Wow. So not only would communities have to contend with this mine, they'd have to contend with the downstream effects, but also a natural gas pipeline.
Yes, also a natural gas pipeline.
Wow. In what ways could this mine affect the region's commercial fishing industry, which is a major, major source of employment for Alaskans?
Right. So we were starting to imagine Bristol Bay and these 32 tribal villages. Well, there's this community called Dillingham that in Alaska is what we call a hub community. It's where people coming from those smaller towns and whatever stores and work there is in the region, there's a community college there. And so Dillingham, for example, 75% of jobs rely on commercial fishing. And so a lot of these same folks that are doing subsistence set netting are out doing commercial drift netting as well. So they'll catch their subsistence kings, put them up, and then take their family boat out, and they'll commercial fish. So when an industry is able to provide 75% of the jobs in a community, those jobs are sustainable last year was the largest returning population of sockeye. So the population is actually growing. It's a healthy fishery, which for folks in the Northwest who have seen salmon counts go down, the value of a healthy fishery is not to be denied. And so I think that that is why so many folks in the commercial fishing community, many of whom wintered down in the lower 48 in Washington and Oregon and are getting ready now to go up and fish in Bristol Bay, are saying, hey, this is a threat to our way of life too, to our jobs that depend on a renewable resource. Of course, the mine, they're only applying for a 20-year permit now. So we're talking about something that could sustain one or two generations versus something that has sustained generations of fisher people for thousands of years.
What type of reputation does this company have from past mining projects, and what kind of tone has the company leadership taken in bringing this project to the public?
Under the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People, which President Obama signaled his support for, which has found precedent in U.S. courts, Indigenous people have the right to go through a consent process when a major industrial player wants to develop something near their homes. It's called free, prior, and informed consent. So free, meaning that they have the right to say no. Prior, being that this happens before the project, and informed, being that the mining company is forthcoming with the details of their plans. I think it's fair to say that the Pebble Limited Partnership has failed on all three of those accounts. Like any colonial, like you listen to these names, like Anglo-American, right? So a big colonial international mining conglomerate comes in, and their approach is to divide and conquer. They say, all right, the opposition will pay off some of them. And so Pebble Limited Partnership has made donations to entities in Bristol Bay. One community member told me they're just shoving a check in anywhere they can get it in, whether that's being the largest underwriter of local radio stations so that the radio stations really have to be on their toes about whether they cover this, or newspapers, whether it's even noticing when a powerful opponent of the mine has a health crisis and this is the time to offer them a big check. It's the same kind of divide and conquer politics that I think we see from many large resource development corporations around the world.
So it sounds like they're attempting to control the entire conversation through funding. Has that worked? Are there media entities and opponents of the mine that have largely faded away following these checks?
Sure, absolutely. You know, it's been really effective. You know, Alaska is a small pond when it comes to this, and so they have been able to silence folks effectively with these tools. What's really important is that people are now saying, we don't want your money, right? We want your documents. We want the truth. Like, what is the economic baseline study for this mine? And the mining company has refused calls from even the Army Corps of Engineers during the permitting process, as well as a bunch of other stakeholders who want the economic feasibility study for this, because one of the mining companies that walked away, Rio Tinto, one of their permitting experts, has written a memo that says that there is no way that this is economically feasible the way you've proposed it. So in essence, they're proposing a 20-year mine to get through permitting, but the only way it's economically feasible is if they do a much bigger mine. 2 months after they submitted their proposal to permitting, they submitted an addendum increasing the size of the mine by 25%. So I think a lot of people feel that the mining company is not honest with what they say they're going to do, and they're not providing the information needed to make a clear assessment of the process. So that's a violation of the NEPA, free, prior, and informed consent under the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous People and of Alaska state law. One example of how local politics work in Alaska is that we recently had an election in November. There was the Save Our Salmon initiative that would have provided state agencies with the additional regulatory authority to block a project like the proposed Pebble Mine. That ballot initiative lost, perhaps in part because it was outspent 14-1. Mining supporters weren't shy about funding the no vote. In that same election, Mike Dunleavy was elected the new governor of Alaska. Mike's three daughters work at the Red Dog Mine. In Mike's first, Governor Dunleavy's first public appearance as governor of the state of Alaska, he spoke at a mining conference in which he complimented John Shively, the former CEO of the Pema Limited Partnership, on a first-name basis, called him right out. He appointed a former, and this is still going through approval in the state house, but he put forth an appointee for Department of Environmental Conservation in the state of Alaska, which also holds some of the state-level permits that Pebble would need. And the man he appointed to that had worked for Anglo-American in Alaska trying to get Pebble permitted. So it's, you know, it's like what we see with Trump's appointees in Washington, putting the same corporate lobbyists in charge of regulating their former clients.
Part two of my interview with filmmaker Josh Tucker will air next week. The Army Corps of Engineers is accepting public comments on the proposed Pebble Mine until May 30th.